Hello, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast. My name is Father Gregory Pine. I'm an assistant director of the Thomistic Institute, or at the Thomistic Institute, or prepositions are hard, so you choose the one that suits your fancy best. I learned this while learning German, as it came with the terrible recognition that I'll always answer wrong. So whatever I say, choose something else. But I'm delighted for this episode to be joined by Professor Joseph Capizzi from the Catholic University of America. Thanks for joining.
My pleasure, Father. Thank you for having me.
So you were recently appointed or named the Dean of the School of Theology and Religious Studies the Catholic University of America, and had previously served as the Director of the Institute for Human Ecology at the Catholic University of America. And your publications are varied and wide-ranging. We'll zoom in on a particular area of competence today, but could you say maybe another word or two of introduction, who you are, where you're from, and what you're doing these days?
Yeah, sure. Like you said, I'm now the dean, but I've been teaching at Catholic University since 1997. It was my first gig straight out of Notre Dame. I was still completing my dissertation at that point. I've been a professional moral theologian all my life, which was probably the unlikeliest thing I thought I would ever end up to be. But it's been a remarkable privilege to serve the church in this way, you know, to really dig into some of the toughest questions through now three papacies, and three very different papacies, as we're all aware. But in each case, they have provided us material to chew on. It's just an amazing thing to participate in the church in this manner, and also in the formation of priests and religious. And this is something that I've done since I arrived at Catholic, you know, nearly 30 years ago now. And some of the people that we have trained are now bishops. And even in one case, one of my students is an archbishop. So it's really an amazing gift to have been able to be involved in the church in this way. And also to get to talk about all the interesting moral questions that all us Catholics have and other people outside the church have.
Yeah. People don't always know the kind of institutional boundaries or institutional frontiers in this neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Typically, they think that I teach at the Catholic University of America, which is a great compliment, but I assure you I lack the academic chops for such like things. So the Dominican House of Studies is across the street from the Catholic University of America. And yeah, there are various kind of levels of involvement, but we cross the street to kind of pitch in over there, and then folks from Catholic University cross the street to pitch in over here. Any highlights or lights of any sort over the course of the past 25 years when it comes to Dominican Catholic youth things?
Yeah, for sure. Look, I think to your point, I don't think a lot of people understand at all the different moving parts of the Catholic Church, and especially, you know, those that are in what we all call Little Rome, or used to call Little Rome. So when I first arrived on campus in 97, the crossing the street from Catholic University to Dominican House, you would have thought it was another world you were entering. And one of the people who reached out to me as a relatively new faculty member, and I think I had a little bit of a reputation of being, you know, an angry young man, was your older brother, Father Gustinoia, right? Or Bishop Gustinoia. And what a, you know, privilege to me to have him kind of tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, look, I'd love for you to be involved in what we're doing at the Dominican House and to get to know you a little bit better. We, of course, have the Southern Italian thing in common. So that there was that helped our relationship. But it was the beginning for me personally of a deeper relationship with the Dominican House. And eventually, I just became closer to more and more people in that community. And now, of course, I've worked directly with the Thomistic Institute through the Institute for Human Ecology. And as the dean, it's my hope that we can have more integrated relationship, at the highest level of academics, but also, of course, socially and otherwise, between the Dominican House, my school, and also, of course, the other religious communities, again, that we're all really like remarkably blessed to have in our lives.
Yeah, it's prior to pushing record, we were talking a little bit about being Italian. I don't think I'm as Italian as you are. Certainly, I don't bear an Italian name as you do. My mother was Italian. And one thing that I like is, so, you know, people say that like politeness or courtesy or decorum, the purpose of which is, you know, to set the other at ease, kind of gives you a sense of where you ought to be and how you ought to comport yourself in a social setting. Now, I think there are a lot of cultures where what they project is that you're doing all right. But what I love about Italians is they project like exactly how you're doing in fact. Mm. So it might not be good, but at least you know where you stand. So you always knew where you stood with my mother. It was like, you're in the doghouse. It's like, okay, when will that change? Like, rarely?
No question. I think it's actually a Mediterranean thing in particular, right? Like you even see this among, I've been, you know, in southern Spain before, and I know this is true of Israelis and Greeks and people like that. There's a kind of directness about almost everything. You're either too heavy, you're too thin, you're too, you know, you're too angry, you know, you're like, I mean, it's almost never you're in a good place, right? There is some sort of something that can get a little bit better here.
For me, it was always eat some more, you're so skinny. I was like, okay,
yeah,
noted.
Right, that's right.
I'm just trying to waste away for the entirety of my earthly existence and see what comes of it. Right. Okay, speaking of Mediterranean cultures, we're going to kind of direct our gaze towards Spain, towards one of your areas of competence. So Francisco de Vitoria, his kind of causes, just causes of war or unjust causes of war. But maybe before we get into particular details as concerns international law or his exchange with various persons working in the New World, we could just talk a little bit about the just war theory, maybe in general.
Sure.
So as Catholics, where do you typically lead people into the argument, or where do you lead people into the tradition? Is there a good onboarding point?
You can answer that question differently, Father, right? You could answer that in terms of like, what's the sort of stuff I should read, right, to get a sense of things. And so let's just start there. I typically will direct people towards, parts of Augustine, where I think the virtue of looking at it from that perspective is to see that for Augustine, the just war theory is not, or the just war points of view are not detachable from broader and deeper theological claims, right? They actually all are informed by those sorts of things. And then, you know, in a way, both in terms of the way that the story goes and also the next most formative moment, right? You would look at Aquinas, right? And you look at his question on war and see there, he's in fact, of course, talking to and with Augustine, among a couple of others, on the same question. So in terms of like, where should I look to begin thinking about this? There are parts of the City of God you'd go to, a couple of Augustine's letters that are kind of famous for looking at the question, and then probably Aquinas' question on the, is war always sinful? If you're thinking of it in terms of like, how ought I think about it, right? This is where I depart from a lot of contemporary Catholic and non-Catholic thinking. I think, like I said earlier, it's a position that is deeply connected to the moral theology of the church in general, which of course is connected to the church's theology, and in particular, the way it thinks about politics or life in a community. Right. And life in a community is ordered towards a kind of shared good. Because it's ordered towards a kind of shared good, there is the need for an authority. Right. Because there's a need for an authority, that authority has certain privileges that those who are not in authority don't have. And the authority has as its responsibility the protection of the people within the community. And that discrete community is, it's in a sense, first priority. As that authority, it protects that community in particular. Now, there are borderline questions that arise with relationship to all of that, but that's the place to begin to think about, okay, well, how does the use of force in order to protect that community get handled from a moral perspective? And once you start thinking like that, of course, the first thing you think of is within the community, right? Like, right, there are things that will happen within a community that challenge particular members of it and that require the use of force to direct people towards the good that, you know, the community is pursuing. And then in extremer cases, you have the things that emerge outside the community as threats against the community. And that's where the language of war more or less emerges, right? When those external threats to that community begin to emerge. So for me, it begins with a kind of political, you might call it a political theology, even, and then derives from that. It's not some sort of like theoretical apparatus that you just sort of break the glass when the Russians invade or something like that.
Yeah, I taught briefly at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was supposed to teach Catholic social teaching. So, as you might expect, I just put my students through RCIA because the idea is like you can only appreciate Catholic social teaching as the kind of ripe fruit of an organic life, which is ecclesial life. So I figured they should know something of
That's right.
The church's like doctrinal and practical life in order to appreciate why these things matter. But I think too, with like Just War Theory, I think that's a super helpful point to keep in mind. If you treat it in isolation from the church's doctrinal tradition, then it can begin to seem like a kind of deductive, you know, like empirico mathematico system, which in divorcing it from a personalistic context, it begins to seem strange. Right. And then you have people inveighing against it or people lobbying for it in a weird way. So like, I don't know how comforting it is to the student to say, in order to learn this thing, you need to learn everything. It's like, oh my gosh, how am I going to get a job / specialize / publish? It's like, it's okay. You know, just kind of like immerse yourself in the church's life and cultivate the epistemic humility to say, I'm going to not only learn this issue better, but I'm going to learn its setting better, its context better, the related doctrines better, you know, like, I don't know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And so,
go
ahead.
No, I was going to say, so you raise really interesting questions, right? In that, like, one is just about specialization itself, right? Which is, on the one hand, right, we all think we want to be experts at something, right? If you have any ambition, it's like, look, I want to really know something. And to know something these days especially means to know some very, very thin slice of something very, very well, right? But that's an interesting modern or current phenomenon, right? That we think of that as a kind of expertise when if you go back and you look at the best theologians, and you can do this with philosophers and anything else, right? Go back and look at the best theologians, the ones we all esteem, even up until the middle of the 20th century, right? Even ones you might say, geez, I'm not really a fan of, but those guys knew a lot, right? They knew, like, just as an example, take Rahner, right? Whatever anyone thinks of Rahner, right? Rahner knew a lot, right? So he could opine on questions with regard to the Trinity or the development of dogma, right? Or, broader dogmatic questions about, you know, the understanding of God. And then also speak about ethical issues and other sorts of things. Of course, you know, Pope Benedict XVI was another example of this. So it's not like this is that far from us. Most of us, however, we not only pursue, we're encouraged to pursue a kind of sliver and become expert in it. And it damages, in fact, our tradition. And of course, it will distort the sliver. And this is what happens with Just War Theory at its worst. It becomes this theory. And you break out the theory and you start to ask questions. And when you ask these questions in the deductive manner, you just suggested, well, no war is just if the whole point is, you know, every single thing that we deductively check off has to meet some standard, right? Of course, there are injustices in the course of war, but everybody already knew that, right? Augustine, you know, this describes the horrors of war very, very well before proceeding to say, nonetheless, right, there are wars that are just to pursue. And how can he say that? Because he's got an account that explains the presence of injustice in our lives, almost the inescapability of injustice, especially in social or political settings, right?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe then that's a good point at which to transition to like the just war criteria,
sure,
as it's sometimes called. Maybe if you could take us through the Augustinian proposal, maybe, I don't know, the Thomistic formulation insofar as they're at all divergent. And then it sounds like, you know, by the time we arrive at the 19th, 20th century, there are further kind of prudential measures put in place as a way by which to specify or determine the application or the actual deployment. So any of that you think is helpful for background conversation, that'd be appreciated.
Yeah. So, I mean, generally speaking, there are understood to be these two categories, right, within the just war analysis. The first category is like it's first in many, like many ways, right? Both in terms of like logical priority, right? It's the one that you have to go through in order to begin to think about the second category. And that is the jus ad bellum, essentially, can this war in fact be the right war, the right use of force right now? And that raises the questions, going back to my earlier points, of authority, right? Has the authority in fact made a judgment that some wrong, some cause, right, so, which is another of the criteria, has arisen that needs to be vindicated in some sense, or repelled, I guess, might be a more contemporary way of understanding it, right? So you have authority, you have just cause, and then you have right intentionality. These are the classic criteria associated with it, and with the analysis. And the intentionality is peace. It has to be ordered towards the good of peace, which is itself, or direct, let's say, directed towards the good of peace, peace being an ordering of the community and its relationship with other communities that is more just than, you know, prevails as a consequence of the cause that has emerged. And those all work together. You know, they're not really independent of each other. And I would even argue that they're distinct, but not, you know, ultimately separable from each other. I would even argue that those three criteria, in fact, contain all of the proliferation of other criteria that we see, you know, today. For instance, like last resort, right? Last resort really is kind of baked into right intentionality, right? You know, that the intention of peace can only be served by the use of force now rather than diplomacy or something else is kind of baked into right intention. So those are the ad bellum criteria. And then you have the classic in bello criteria, which are basically observing non-combatant immunity. You cannot direct your use of force against innocent or people who are uninvolved in the aggression. You cannot direct that use of force against them. And then proportionality. There has to be a kind of proportionality in any of the actions you take in order to vindicate the cause. And there's a lot of course prudential analysis built into all of this. But those are the general criteria of the theory and point of analysis. And there's of course a lot of dispute about, you know, this or that aspect of them. But I think, in fact, that because sometimes you'll hear, well, is it obsolete today? I think that's like saying, is action analysis obsolete? It can't possibly be obsolete because all you're describing is a kind of act analysis, right? Like this act of the use of force is now a reasonable act. And that's how we operate in our own lives. And that's how those in authority for governing a particular polity have to act as well.
Okay, so maybe just thinking as I want to kind of touch on Vittoria or touch on the peculiar situation in the New World at the end of the 15th, early 16th century, yeah. Maybe a good transition point or inflection point would be defensive war and punitive war. Right. It seems like the consensus theory as it's currently formulated is that you can only justify a defensive war or a war seen from some vantage as defensive, where in past centuries there was, I suppose, greater latitude given or a kind of conceptual space accorded to a punitive war. What's the lay of the land there, and where can we find something like along the lines of a development of doctrine?
Yeah. So for sure, in the 20th century, in the middle of the 20th century, as a consequence of the Second World War, you get a both in terms of international humanitarian law, which is basically the law of war that obtains between states, nation states, today and since, you know, the middle of the 20th century, you see this move away from the language of punitive war, which really obtained through the entirety of the tradition. The notion that you could wage war in order to punish an aggressor, somebody that had committed a wrong and there by that commission of the wrong had merited, essentially earned, the kind of punishment that could even include the use of force that we call war. In the middle of the 20th century, because and this is the narrative, right? Because of the horrors of war, because of the advances of within technology, in particular, aerial bombing, right? I mean, this is the biggest advance, you know, First World War to Second World War, and obviously with, you know, atomic weapons, but really it's aerial bombing in itself that more or less kind of transforms the nature of war, because now you're bringing war immediately to cities, right? And you're doing so in a manner that's pretty destructive. There was this notion that that's so horrible, we need to limit it as much as possible. We're only going to allow a justification for it that is defensive. Generally speaking, like if you look at the papal documents, they'll say against ongoing aggression. One country is continuing to attack another, so it's not stopped, right? And sort of said, okay, we're going to put our weapons down, but maybe we'll remain where we are. We're going to stay in your land, or maybe we even pull back. It's still going, because if it stops, you're not going to justify perhaps that as defensive. So against ongoing aggression, it would be permissible to defend oneself even to the use of force. Now, the challenge with this has become states continue to act more or less the way they did, you know, and the language of defense just has become elastic. And this is my, you know, my argument. It's not merely my argument. Another person who makes this argument is the Anglican theologian Oliver O'Donovan, that you really haven't gotten rid of what would have in the past been describable in terms of punitive action. You've just stretched the language of defense to now include things that in the past would have come under the language of punitive justifications. So states are still operating materially in the same way as they did in the past, but with a different kind of language, which, you know, I mean, those of us who care about these things would say is somewhat dishonest, right? You know, when you misuse language, you're abusing things, and those abuses won't have good consequences for either your thinking, right, or perhaps even the world you inhabit. And, you know, the obvious, like, sort of thing to point to is in the United States when after 9/11, which of course we're only a few days away from, it's a memorial, there was a lot of talk about preventative war, right? You know, in other words, war to stop something that is not even imminently about to happen. That would have been understood as a kind of punitive action in the past, rather than seeking for, well, is this in fact a defense, right? And when you think of it as a punitive type activity, you may actually understand and maybe limit even your approach to it, rather than thinking, you know, arguably, it would be a longer argument, that this defensive activity actually, in fact, justifies a kind of dismantling of the other state that we're now defending ourselves against, and a propping up of something else, you know, in its place. So it's not clear that the move, in fact, has had the kind of good consequences that people would have desired, let's say.
Yeah. Okay, then, turning to the late 15th, early 16th century. I think a lot of folks, when they come at the issue from a 21st century vantage, look on whatever, like the encomienda system, and are horrified and have little in the way of sympathy with those who would have, you know, kind of prosecuted war after this manner, or would have perpetrated the kind of offenses that you hear described in the subsequent tradition. But it sounds like kind of boots on the ground, things were more ambiguous insofar as, like, there are different, you know, causes at stake. So there's like a question, for instance, as to whether these people are people like we're people, and as a result of which, whether they have dominion like we have dominion. Or there's the question of, you know, like human sacrifice. Is that the type of sin which actually cedes one's rights? And then the further question of evangelization, you know, is like, is this the type of trump card that one can play in foreign lands? You know, so like there's a lot of arguments going on. And I'm wondering if maybe you can just describe how Francisco de Vitoria helped to organize that discourse and maybe shed some light on that discourse as it developed.
Yeah, sure. And it might be the sort of thing, Father, where, you know, it'll be good for you to stop me every once in a while and, you know, make sure we're just being as precise as possible, because there's a lot going on, right? So,
yeah,
I mean, we all kind of know the story, right? The Spaniards enter, you know, the quote unquote New World, and they They're doing so under the auspices both of evangelization, right? It's pretty clear, right, that there's an evangelical inspiration to some of this activity. And of course, there's other, you know, inspirations to the activity. And that's humanity, right? Humans have mixed motivations as they pursue things. And those motivations include things like growing an empire and becoming a wealthier empire, which means, you know, nothing more, pernicious than bringing about a better life for the people in the empire, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's what we do. That's what they did. And, you know, and it's coupled with what they see as very noble goals. They encounter new peoples when they hit the ground, and, you know, eventually conflict ensues. And we have to remind ourselves, of course, that there's, this is a world away, a hemisphere away from Spain, from, you know, the great, from the decision makers, the, you know, the authorities, the highest authorities. And reports are going back and forth between Spain and the New World. And some of the reports are of the barbarism of the new peoples that the Spanish are encountering. And some of the reports are also of the barbaric behavior of the Spaniards themselves, right? And Vitoria, one of the leading minds of that age, you know, one of the most important figures in the Catholic tradition, sifts through these things, both in terms of the evangelical goals being pursued by the church and by the Spanish Empire, and also in terms of the morality, right, of what exactly is happening. He cares about the moral questions. And like you said, he starts to sort of say, well, what exactly is going on here? Is this in fact a war, or is this something else? And if it is a war, because there's obviously violence, there's, you know, there's force being used by the Spanish and by the local populations, how are we to understand its justification? And he very analytically goes through possible means by which the Spaniards not only could, but are justifying their use of force against these people. And some of those include the sorts of things that you mentioned, asking questions about jus, or dominion, the right that the Spanish have over the land that they encounter as they explore the New World. The people that they run into, are these people human beings? Right. And are they human beings in the way that Spaniards are? So the questions are of the sort, like, are they insensate? You know, are they some kind of being that is, you know, not quite at the same cognitive level as the Spaniards might be? Are they like children? You know, are they, in other words, civilizationally, they're somewhat behind us, and therefore they need an authority, right, to lead them forward, right? So and he connects these questions to the claims that if they are like children, it is held that they could not own their own property, right? Or if they are insensate, it is held that they could not own their own property. If they're mad, it is held that they could not own their own property. And he kind of explores all of these claims very analytically and rejects almost all of them, right? He rejects almost all of them and says, these things are wrong. Children can be wrong, right, with regard to property, for instance, is a claim that Vitoria makes, right, that children can be the subject of injustice, in other words, with regard to their property. And, you know, from some perspectives, these would strike us as very progressive ideas that Vitoria advances. So it certainly adds a level of sophistication to any claim that the Spanish are just thoughtlessly overriding indigenous populations of people as they enter the New World. In fact, they're taking these questions very seriously, so seriously that rather famously, these questions get brought back to Spain. And there's a famous disputation between Las Casas and Sepulveda precisely on these kinds of questions. Do the indigenous populations have, you know, right over the property that they hold? Or if not, then does that mean the Spanish have claims over them that they can vindicate by the use of force and so on? So that's, this is why, you know, just war is located in politics. These are political claims, and they're also large. They're all connected to larger theological claims. This is about baptism, right? This is about the spreading of sacraments for the Spanish. We don't think this way, of course, any longer, but that was a people that did, a political people that did, that thought of all of this is connected, you know, and all of this is connected to the good of both the Spanish and the people that they were engaging. I'll pause there, Father, if you want to enter into it, you know.
Yeah, no, it's... So my first thought is that I'm thinking of McIntyre,
yeah,
and how McIntyre kind of describes the failure of the Enlightenment project, this idea of reasoning from nowhere or of assuming an impartial stance before a line of argumentation, whether yeah. ethical or political. Just it's you know, it's just not going to happen whenever, you know, human beings are involved. And so, like, what we can hope for, the type of goods that are at stake, which we want to appropriate, are something like, you know, virtuous life. We don't want to pretend to be impartial. We want to account for our partiality, include that in the discourse and adjust for it, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about, like, how difficult it is, ethical argumentation, but, like, then political argumentation, because you have people who want to, you know, take land, and then you have people who want to, you know, like, I'm thinking about de las Casas when he says, in a kind of, you know, terrible lament, almost of quasi-despair, like, it would have been better had we never come.
Right.
You know, it's like that type of admission is, it's terrible to have cross one's lips. But then you think of then trying to navigate these just causes, or trying to, like, reason one's way through these just causes, and to do so in a way that accounts for your partiality in, you know, in the midst of a world historical moment, as an entire hemisphere is being populated by another hemisphere. Yeah, I wonder if maybe, like, kind of bringing it back to the 20th and 21st century, I don't know if there are particular practices that help to account for partiality in ethical and political discourse as it concerns war, or, like, you know, like, we're all in the midst of it now as we look at the, you know, Israel-Hamas situation, as we look at the Russia-Ukraine situation, and we're all sensitive to the fact that it's being politicized in ways that make us, you know, somewhat uncomfortable, regardless of where we fall in the political spectrum or how we might come down on the issue. When we hear somebody say, it's crystal clear, you can feel, like, the people in the room just kind of say, ah. So, yeah, I don't know if that's kind of an impressionistic beginning of a question, not so much a question, but if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, look, so let's go back to Victoria really quickly to begin to answer this question. And it's a great question. Right. The thing about war, and we can see this really well right now with Ukraine and Russia, or the Hamas situation, is that both sides can make a reasonable narration of the justice and injustice of what is happening from their perspective. Right. So Vittoria identifies this problem, and he doesn't, because of that identification, say, therefore, there cannot possibly be a just cause. It's clear, in fact, to him, there can only be one just cause. You can, however, and should acknowledge the fact that from the perspective of the party that, you know, it basically is not the just cause party, there is this kind of reasonable perspective, you know, hey, you know, you're pushing NATO down our throat, right? Or, hey, there are Germans in the Czech Republic, or what? There are these things that can be stitched together, even in unjust situations, right? That are not merely plausible, but that have a motive power to people, right? That are express the partiality, to use your term, of that people. And Vittoria counsels that if your end is peace, right, and you are pursuing the just cause, you ought to take into effect the perspective of the other party as you prosecute the war, right? As you prosecute this thing. So to enlighten yourself to some extent to both that perspective, but also what materially will be necessary to make sure you can build a surer peace, right? So he talks about the authority of the just party as operating like a judge, almost above the fray. He recognizes you can't be above the fray, but seeing the whole and now trying to manage the political future of this in a manner that is more conducive to peace between the opposing sides, right? So that perspective, I think, in fact, informs everything about the just war analysis that was carried through the Catholic tradition. You sometimes hear now of jus postbellum. It's not a category that I find very helpful because, again, it's built into right intentionality, and Vittoria makes that really clear by this kind of claim. Yes, the post-bellum situation has to be managed by the way you wage the war, right? You can't just go in there, kill a bunch of people and leave, right? Or not address questions about, well, what are we going to do about NATO, right? Like, what are we going to do about the reasonable Russian perspective, for instance, that the United States not have its presence, you know, so close to itself, right? That's not irrational, right? This is why, again, the just war analysis encourages the individual party to recognize the rationality, in other words, of the perspective that it's opposing, rather than saying they're just mad, right? Which, again, Vittoria rejects this stuff. He says, no, look at it from the perspective that they're, in fact, rational. That's, I think, a great gift, and it actually helps in terms of thinking about the real political scaffolding that has to be put into place to build a peace after the conflict ends. Otherwise, you do just get into reprisal and vengeance and, you know, these other sorts of things, which lots of people have long memories, and peoples have long memories, right? As we see, especially, you know, in the Middle East and, you know, and the Mediterranean, right? Those are peoples with long memories, and they're going to remember being mistreated. So it's better, in fact, to do your best to be as impartial as you possibly can and try to see this from the perspective of the rationality of the and reasonability of the positions that you're opposing.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, on the one hand, you think about like the Montagues and the Capulets and the Shepherdsons and the Grangerfords, and it's just like, yeah, blood feuds will continue until blood feuds continue. Right. And, you know, you've got various factors which would tend in that direction, like racial, ethnic, religious, you know, when it becomes very personal. And it seems like in order to train a fighting force, there's a kind of dehumanization that need take place in order to get people ready and poised or primed for the taking of life. You almost have to dehumanize those against whom they find themselves pitted, because it seems like that's the tactic typically deployed by fighting forces. And yet, in dehumanizing them, you're creating the conditions in which to perpetuate the violence beyond the prosecution of the war, which is just it's just devastating. It's just like, it's like anger. You know, we talk about Jesus was righteously angry. Now cite for me another example. It's like, well, it gets harder. You know, it just strikes me as such like a very potent thing to wield that the chances of our wielding it well are low.
And I think that's probably true. You know, I don't think there's any easy answer to this. You know, it is life in the human family. And again, this is why it's really important to see this enveloped in a larger theological framework, which has, to some extent, as one of its key features, forgiveness, right? And forgiveness is vexing. I was just reading something the other day on the mindset of Nazi Germany, written by this French scholar. And it's really interesting to see how forgiveness is rejected by a lot of the intellectualizing of intellectual Nazis at the time as this kind of weak Jewish Christian, you know, perspective that all it does, in fact, is undermine the manliness of, you know, the natural German. But that's just a kind of extreme perspective on how challenging forgiveness is. And it's partly forgiveness because we can't eradicate what you just described from human living. And Augustine is really wonderful. There's a couple of passages in the City of God where he talks about this from a political perspective, but then he like really focuses it on the family. And he says, you know, of course, the interesting thing is even within the family, you see this stuff. And of course, sometimes the harshest injustices are among family members, right? So there's this kind of, he's just making the point again, that there's this kind of inescapability of all of this, the hatred and the anger and the unforgettable injustices against each other are just going to be there, right? But it would be, it's unimaginable to, or maybe it's not unimaginable, maybe it is imaginable and frightening to think about what the world might look like if you still didn't have governing authority, you know, doing its best within this situation, or even like within the family, right? Paternal authority doing its best to sort of point everybody towards a kind of shared good, despite, you know, their constant chaotic behavior towards each other. So you're right. It's inescapable. Augustine says you cannot carry hatred as, you know, one as an subjective intentionality into conflict. And of course, you want to say, well, geez, I wonder who did that. Like, who was able, you know, who was able not to hate the enemy as he was smiting the enemy? But that's the task that human beings have before them. Right? That's, and it's super challenging. And they have to forgive themselves as well, not merely forgive the other.
This is, I suppose, like a little bit of a tricky question. But maybe just as a last thought, I'm wondering, it seems like, okay, so for forgiveness to work, you have to both ask it, you have to ask for it, and then you have to accept it, and then everyone has to agree to move on. So I'm thinking about like the differentiation between treatment of Germans and Russians on the European continent over the course of the last 75 years, because it's like Germans have a sense that they're a nation born in sin, and like you won't see a German flag flown in Germany except when the German team is playing in the World Cup. You know, like the, like nationalism is still, I don't know, it's like a thing that they haven't yet reappropriated, except in places, you know, like Leipzig, for instance, which were behind the Berlin Wall and that had that very strong hand for 45 years that was then released. And then you see a kind of resurgence, you know, so it's like things are still somewhat cattywampus. But then you have a, you know, like you have Russia on the other hand. And when you think about ethnic cleansing or you think about genocide, I'm not going to compare things, but I'm just saying a lot of stuff happened there. And there's never been the same kind of reckoning for Russia as there has been for Germany. And so it's like to say just transactionally, forgiveness just has a lot of moving parts. Yeah. And you can just see all the ways in which forgiveness can go wrong. I don't know if you have a, you know, just from your engagement with the just war tradition, are there examples in which you feel like people have come back together or people have healed up, or are we basically waiting for the second coming at this point?
The easy answer is to say the last, we're waiting. The post-war Japanese and American experience, right, has been, rather instructive. And obviously, it's beginning, you know, in the middle of the 20th century is horrific. And now we're, you know, close allies and even sort of at the level of common human experience, right? Of just, you know, the rest of us, there seems to be a lot of good natured relationships. That wasn't always the case as late as even the 80s. If you go back to the 80s, you'll see some horrible movies about the sort of Japanese threat to the United States. I mean, horrible comedies written about, you know, the Japanese stereotyping, which were really carryovers from my father's generation, you know, for mm-hmm. whom that was very difficult to sort of get over. The war, the treatment of American prisoners, the treatment of the Chinese, et cetera. But it seems like there's been a kind of positive move since about that time. In terms of the German-Russian thing, quite honestly, I don't have an answer to that. All I can say is that even at the time, it's fascinating. If you go back and you read the exchanges between like Karl Barth and Reinhold Niebuhr over their mutual analyses of these threats, where Niebuhr is like, look, the communist thing is just as awful as the Nazi thing, right? Or if he doesn't say just as awful, right, it's almost as, however, you know, he puts it. And Barth is more reluctant to make that kind of judgment, you know? And it's, so for some reason, there is a distinction drawn between the horrors, you know, that occurred on and across that continent. And I mean, obviously Stalin was a hero of many Americans, and especially American intellectuals. That's a record that I think a lot of people would be embarrassed by, you know, to have thrown themselves behind now. But at the time, he was a hero. And of course, you can point to the Mitford sisters and others, and, you know, in the West, who found Hitler, you know, heroic or something. But it was a much more widespread thing, and a longer duration to a kind of fancying of what Russia was up to. But I don't know enough to know why that's the case. Yeah. And it's obviously very delicate when, as you start to sift it and try to figure out what's going on there, but it'll lead you to be eschatological.
Yeah.
There's no question. It'll lead you to be eschatological when you look at it from the perspective today and say, well, where does this all go? You know?
Yeah.
So it will lead you back to the easier, shorter, truer response. You know?
Yeah. I just think you think of just at the level of an individual human being, how difficult it is to forgive. And that would seem silly from a certain vantage. It's like, of course you would forgive because then you're free from the burden of unforgiveness. But unforgiveness affords you a certain power of resentment. You know, it affords you a certain power of control wielded by victim, you know, like not to accuse any particular individual of that. But you can see there are accidental goods attached to it as you navigate power politics. So then you scale that up to a nation. It's like, this is tough.
But you may know, Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition says, Jesus introduces forgiveness into politics, right? I mean, right? This is a Jewish writer familiar with the Christian tradition. She wrote a dissertation on Augustine, right? Who is identifying, look, Christ actually introduces something that is politically important, and that is forgiveness. And, you know, it's hard, but that doesn't mean it's wrong, you know, and it doesn't mean that it might not actually be really helpful to keep in mind as a possibility that sometimes states can say, you know what, we're not going to vindicate this cause, right? We're just going to say, we understand, let's try to move forward. And look, to get back to what animated, you know, the sort of concern about just war in the 20th century, the stakes are high. Right. You know, we've got weapons unlike, you know, anyone has ever seen now. The stakes are high, and it's not irrational to think that states can and should say sometimes, we're not going to respond here. You know, we're going to step back from this point and see if we can't get back to the, you know, diplomacy table and try to pursue another way forward rather than what would be just maybe a justifiable reprisal.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, that's super helpful for me, just kind of thinking through the issues. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for taking the time.
Anytime, Father.
All right. So, folks listening in, know that you have options when it comes to graduate school. I have profited from the courses that I myself took at the Catholic University of America. And the dean of the School of Theology and Religious Studies is eager to make your acquaintance. So,
thank you. Thank you for the plug. It was well done.
Hey, cheers. All right. Turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, you can subscribe on your podcast app or on YouTube. Unless it is not profitable for your spiritual intellectual growth, then leave it unsubscribed. All right. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time in the Thomistic Institute podcast.